It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what could change around the country if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade as suggested in a leaked draft ruling. First, housing costs jumped in Wisconsin during the pandemic. That's pushing the dream of home ownership further away for a lot of people. And it's adding pressure to the state's rental market, too. Our next guest says the problem has gotten so bad it should be considered a five-alarm fire. And if he says if trends continue, it could cause young people to leave the state altogether, adding to problems with Wisconsin's worker shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen housing costs go up where you live? Did you try to buy a home during the pandemic? How'd it go? If you're a renter, what's it been like trying to find an affordable place to rent? Builders and landlords love to hear your perspective, too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
I feel like I say this a lot. This is a problem that was going on before the pandemic, and it seems like the pandemic made it worse. Let's go back to pre-pandemic. What were we starting to see then with our housing market?
So across Wisconsin, and particularly in our faster-growing counties, you saw pre-pandemic the fact that we simply did not build enough housing to keep up with population growth and job growth. And so that meant that prices were going up even before the pandemic. And for younger families, first-time home buyers, renters, that meant that it was even hard to find a home, even though interest rates were kind of low, and we were still building a lot of homes. So as you pointed out in the introduction, COVID is just fanning the flames of an already existing kind of burning ember. And in COVID, we saw a huge increase in demand as people realized they wanted to get more space. And then the supply chain difficulties meant that lumber, appliances, all sorts of inputs into housing just skyrocketed in cost.
We'll tackle each of those in turn. What was leading to that shortfall in housing construction that wasn't keeping up with the growth in demand, again, even pre-pandemic?
Right. So as we like to say, when there's a high demand for housing in an area, it's usually caused by job growth or amenities that people want, such as schools. So the solution is always to build more housing where people want to live. But you asked about the challenge. And the true challenge is that most of the people who are already living there don't want more housing to be built. So every time a developer is proposing whether a couple of houses or an apartment building, it has to go through a zoning and local government approval process. And the existing homeowners in the community generally take the view that our neighborhood is full. We can't take more housing. We don't want the extra traffic or school children to crowd the schools. So it's largely, but not completely, driven by the local land use approval process that doesn't allow more housing to be built where people want to live.
Now let's
other factor, of course, is after the Great Recession, banks and lenders tightened lending standards, which just makes it harder for a builder to get a land loan to start building new housing.
Then here comes the pandemic. You mentioned the increased building costs. Can you give us a sense of how big those are? Looking at charts of, you know, lumber and some other things, you really see how much they've increased.
Right. So we like to say that lumber for a 1,000 board feet used to be about $200. And during the pandemic, it was five or six times that, even up to $1,200 for a 1,000 board feet. Today, it's cheap. It's down to only $900. That's meant as a joke. Mm-hmm. It still means that for a single family home, normal framing costs might be about $30,000. And now it might be $75,000 to $80,000. So for the inputs into a single family house in the last 2 years have gone up 36%. And you see similar cost increases for multifamily construction. And that includes not only lumber, but that includes all of the things that go into a house, whether drywall, electrical fixtures, plumbing, appliances, all of that has gone up largely because of demand increase, but also supply chain disruptions.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, looking at the high cost of housing, a lot of factors leading to the cost of houses going up, also rent going up. You can join in with your questions, maybe your own personal experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Kurt, we've got this a large generation of millennials. It's a time in their lives when historically they'd be expected to want to buy a house. What is the reality facing them right now?
Well, as we like to say, it's almost a perfect storm for millennials. So the peak millennial, which is the largest generation in American history, is about 30 or 31 years old today. So that's peak home buying years. So if you look at what happened to the median price of a home for purchase during the pandemic, in a lot of Wisconsin counties, that went up $50,000 to $75,000 in the pandemic. So that means that the entry level price, that bottom rung of the housing ladder, is increasingly out of reach for millennials. Second, because of student loan debt that a lot of millennials have, a dollar in student loan debt is a dollar that you cannot put to mortgage debt because of changes to mortgage underwriting rules after the Great Recession in 2008. The third component is as your rents keep going up and your costs keep going up, it's harder and harder to save for that down payment. So in some ways, it's a triple whammy. And it means that millennials might be persistently shut out of the housing market because even if they can find something to buy in this tight supply market, they're outcompeted by borrowers who can pay all cash or who will waive the inspection contingency. And then the fourth factor, as you heard in the news report today, interest rates are going up. The Federal Reserve just today raised their target interest rate 50 basis points or half a percentage point. And what we will expect is that mortgage rates, which have already climbed a lot in the last 2 months, that mortgage interest rates will go up again in the coming days and weeks.
Can you talk a little about the renter market? You mentioned rents going up. What is driving that?
So like a lot of factors, it's a combination of too much demand and too little supply. So rents in most Wisconsin counties have gone up 10 to even 15 or 20% in the last 2 years. A couple of things have driving that. Number one, a lot of people who would otherwise own a home have been shut out of the ownership market, and so they are staying in the rental market or entering the rental market. That provides competition. The second factor is that the cost of building new rental housing has also gone up about 30 or 35%. So we like to say that the closest substitute for new housing is existing housing, or the closest substitute for existing housing is new housing. So in both the single family and the rental side, when the cost to build new stuff goes way up, then the price of the existing stuff also goes up just because they're substitutes for each other in the market. So a combination of not building enough housing and increased demand and then increased cost of new stuff means that rents have gone up 10 or 15%. And we'll also point out that for most renters, even though their income has gone up during the pandemic, the rent has gone up more, which means on net, you're further behind.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about the housing crisis in Wisconsin, housing costs going up, rent costs too, and what it might take to make housing in the state more affordable. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you struggled to try to buy a home with the big price increases during the pandemic? Success or no? Does buying a home feel completely off the table for you? If you rent, what are you seeing? Are you able to live anywhere near where you work? If you work in housing construction or in rentals, what are you seeing out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, look at some possible solutions coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a lack of affordable housing in Wisconsin, how that can impact everyone, especially the large group of millennials who are at the typical home buying age. Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experience as a renter, a homeowner, somebody trying to buy or sell a home right now, or if you're in building, are you able to get the supplies you need at a reasonable price? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We heard from Bella in southeastern Wisconsin, Kurt, who wondered in part, why aren't politicians doing something to tackle this problem?
Well, that's a great question. I think the reason you don't see a lot of legislative initiatives is it's difficult, it's complicated, and it's expensive. But largely, I think it's because it's been a slow-burning crisis that's been building over the last decade. And if truth be told, you know, the majority of Americans, the majority of Wisconsinites, live in homes that they already own. And for those of us who already live in owned homes, it's actually not a crisis, is it? Because we see that our values are going up. Now, of course, we can't realize that gain until we sell. And if you sell, you have to move somewhere else that's also more expensive. But I think that's the main reason, is that it's a slow-burning crisis. It's not an immediate kind of crisis that drives people to do something. But I would always point out to economic development officials, legislators, that if you don't take any action, then you're going to continue to see these trends continue. And we can just project out where that goes. And if house prices keep going up, and home ownership for low and moderate income households, for first-time home buyers, for young people continues to go down, we're just going to continue to have this challenge in the state.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, they should have never did away with the first-time homeowners buyers program that HUD had out. That helped me get a house and several people I know.
And Tim, could I ask, how long ago were you able to use that program to get your first house?
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago now.
Tim, thanks for the call. I'm not familiar with it, the first-time homeowner program, excuse me, Kurt, via Housing and Urban Development.
Yeah, there's actually a large number of first-time homebuyer programs, which can include down payment assistance programs. I know that our state housing agency, WEDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, has a number of resources and programs available for first-time homebuyers. I think he may be referring to after 2008, there was a short-lived first-time homebuyer tax credit at the federal level, which really did help a lot of people to be able to buy that first home. And so I think we should definitely encourage our legislators at the state and federal level to think about what are the various financial incentives that help younger people to buy that first home, whether it's a reduced cost on the mortgage, whether it's down payment assistance programs, whether it's perhaps tax-advantaged savings programs so that people can save for down payment. I think, as Tim pointed out, a lot of people, including in my generation, were able to get help through these various first-time home buyer programs. And a lot of those have just become not as well funded. And of course, you know, for many first-time homebuyers, saving for that down payment is one of the hardest tasks. And they are sitting there and seeing that as house prices keep going up, the dollars they have to save for a down payment are also going up. So anything we can do, whether it's student loan relief or matching programs with employers, or even tax-advantaged savings accounts to help people save for that down payment will help us to create purchase-ready homeowners.
Thanks for that call, Tim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, looking at the high cost of housing in Wisconsin, renting and buying. You can join in still with your story at 800-642-1234 or your possible solutions. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kurt, is part of the story the kind of housing, the size of houses, the number of bedrooms, the units available to people?
Yes. So one of the things we know is that the fastest growing household type is one and two person households. As we have fewer children and as we age, we have households that no longer meet that kind of 1950s sitcom nuclear family that needs a three or four bedroom house. So one of the things we have to think about doing is providing more flexibility to builders to build smaller condo units or townhouse units, or even what are sometimes called accessory dwelling units or granny flats, ways that people can live in smaller housing units rather than the traditional kind of suburban large-scale home on a large-scale lot. Unfortunately, I think a lot of our communities, because in their zoning ordinances and in what they want that larger home on the larger lot. But the truth is that's just not the majority of households that we see demanding housing today. So any flexibility you can have at a local level to let builders build smaller, more flexible housing types will really help us address this backlog of housing needs.
Let's go back to our callers now. Justin is with us in Madison. Justin, hello.
I had a question about how you believe Airbnb and VRBO rentals play a role in the cost of housing.
Justin, thanks for that call. Kurt, I've heard concerns in some communities, very popular with tourists in particular, where, housing that people could live in is instead is being bought and rented out via those services Justin mentioned.
Right, and I've heard this to be much more of a concern in those really expensive coastal metros like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. And I can imagine it would be a concern in Madison or Green Bay or Milwaukee. But the truth is, I don't think in these housing markets you're seeing a whole lot of demand for Airbnb. But one of the solutions is either to regulate what homeowners can do with their homes, or it's also to just allow more houses to be built in areas where there's a lot of demand for this type of housing. So I guess that's kind of a Weasley answer. I don't know whether it's really a problem in Wisconsin, but I know it's a big concern on the coast.
Justin, thanks for the call. Sonia joins us now in Rice Lake. Sonia, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Sonia?
So my partner and I just bought a house in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, which is about 45 minutes north of Eau Claire. The big problem that we were having was trying to buy a house with a down payment and being priced out basically by people who would bring in all cash offers.
Wow. You were able, you were successful eventually though, Sonia.
Yeah. It took a little finagling and finding a house that no one wanted, but we got one.
Well, I'm glad you've got a house, and I hope you want it, Sonia. Thanks for sharing that. Sonia, not alone in that, Kurt.
No, absolutely. We hear this story all the time. And what it really means is if you are one of these first-time home buyers, and maybe you're using one of the government programs that helps first-time home buyers, whether that is FHA, or if you have a Veterans Administration loan or a USDA loan in rural areas like Barron County, where Sonia is, those require an inspection of the property. And many buyers, when they think that there's multiple offers, they're going to choose the offer that is all cash, doesn't have a finance contingency or an inspection contingency. So as Sonia pointed out, most of our first-time homebuyers, our younger families, are getting outbid. And a lot of them don't want to or cannot pay $30,000 or $50,000 over asking price. Because especially now with mortgage rates going up, they're kind of stretching even to buy that entry-level house price point. So again, the market is really out of whack right now. It's going to start cooling down a little bit because of the interest rate increases. But that's further bad news for people who want to buy homes because their dollar doesn't stretch as far as it used to.
Sonia, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Tom?
Are you there?
Yep, go for it.
Okay. I am a landlord. I have a lot of single-family, two-family duplexes. We just had a place for rent on Facebook, and typically 98 out of 100 people that call, or email us, I should say, have bad credit, police calls where they're at, evictions, no income, poor landlord references. And even though there's a lot of people that can't find housing, I think the reason that they can't find housing is because they have a poor track record.
Tom, and, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left. But, Kurt, if you are, I guess landlords might think of them as marginal renters, somebody who doesn't have a great credit history, and other things Tom listed, that's got to be even more difficult to find housing.
Right. And it's a double-edged sword, because you can understand why landlords might be hesitant to rent to someone with that credit. But also, when rental markets are really tight, landlords get really choosy. And so folks who have maybe a ding on their credit history or an eviction, they make it makes it really hard to find housing. And that's where largely our housing service agencies, our nonprofits, can really work with clients and help them to present a good application, to provide wraparound or supportive services as needed. But I'll be honest, you hear stories on both sides, and it's pretty rough out there. If you can't find a decent place to live, you still have to find some place to live. And oftentimes, people who are the most marginalized or vulnerable end up in really kind of precarious housing situations, as Tom was talking about.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
That's Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison's Department of Urban Planning, looking at an affordability crisis in Wisconsin's housing market. Coming up, what could a post-Roe v. Wade America look like in light of the leaked Supreme Court draft decision indicating it's willing to overturn constitutional protections for abortion? I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit an online space where people from around the country have been sharing memories of people they've lost during the pandemic. Now, one in four women are expected to get an abortion at some point in their lives, a procedure that officially became constitutionally protected in 1973. A draft U.S. Supreme Court decision leaked to the press earlier this week indicating that the court is likely to overturn that landmark decision, leaving regulation of abortion rights to the states. If Roe v. Wade is officially overturned when the court announces its decision this summer, 22 states would likely ban abortion, and at least 9 of those states there would be no exception for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your reaction to this news been? Would an end to the federal protection of abortion affect you personally? If this goes to the states completely, what do you want to see states do? What do you want to see your state do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Clara McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She studies the politics of gender and reproductive health, including abortion. Claire, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As someone who's studied the history of abortion law in the United States, what stood out to you in this leaked draft document?
I think just the sheer breadth of the document in terms of repudiating any basis for asserting a right to abortion. There's no exception to the idea that there's no right, no liberty for abortion to be found in the Constitution, in common practice, and in how we think about abortion as a practice today. That it repudiates a whole host of history that suggests that abortion has been in common practice through American history, even before it was a nation. And it's a pretty stark repudiation of the past 50 years of American jurisprudence.
If this is, in fact, the Supreme Court's ultimate decision in the summer, is there a time in American history that you would compare to a post-Roe landscape?
Yeah, so immediately before Roe v. Wade, from about 1968 to 1973, I think gives us the most stark point of comparison. This was a period of time after several states had already liberalized their abortion laws, and you saw abortion counseling networks work to help get women access to the money necessary to go to states like New York, to go to countries like Mexico or Japan, if you lived in Hawaii, in order to have access to abortion. What that meant is that abortion was really about stratified access. If you had money, it didn't matter where you lived in the country, you could still have access to abortion. If you didn't, then you often made recourse to criminal abortion, which put you at the whims of people who were inexperienced, unscrupulous, and ultimately put the health of countless women in danger. Beyond that, many women testified to just how humiliating and degrading the experience was. So as many commentators have noted, making abortion criminal doesn't get rid of abortion. It gets rid of safe access to abortion, and it makes sure that women make recourse to criminal methods for control of their fertility.
What are some of the key differences today, 2022, versus those last few years pre-Roe v. Wade that you would point toward?
So two of the largest issues are thinking about how much surveillance is part of our lives today versus pre-Roe. We're tracked on our cell phones. We make appointments through electronic means. We can be tracked in terms of what we order in the mail. All of these things have vastly expanded how people can be tracked if they make recourse to criminal means. At the same time, we also see vastly new forms of access to safe abortion. So abortion pills, medical kind of governed abortion makes it safe up through even 12 weeks, according to the WHO. And so you'll find people making recourse to less dangerous means once abortion is criminalized. At the same time, we see states like Texas, Oklahoma, Idaho deputizing citizens as surveillance agents in order to ensure that women don't feel safe when seeking abortion care.
Now, according to the Mayo Clinic, about somewhere from 10 to 20% of known pregnancies end in a miscarriage. Does that, with that kind of surveillance you're talking about, does that raise questions about how enforcement would work, distinguishing between a miscarriage that can occur to anyone at any time versus an abortion or someone taking abortion pills?
Right. So the issue cuts both ways. A medical abortion is indistinguishable from a non-induced miscarriage. And so if there are complications, there is no reason that somebody would have to disclose how their miscarriage, how the end of their pregnancy was affected. By the same token, however, this creates new scrutiny of anybody who's experiencing a miscarriage. Across the country, we've already seen people who have non-induced miscarriages criminalized. In Indiana, a woman was sentenced to 20 years in prison because of a miscarriage. And so in a state and a political environment where there is a heightened desire for the punishment of women or anybody who terminates a pregnancy, miscarriages will become increasingly suspect as well, endangering even those who are not seeking abortion care.
Clara McKinney is with us from the College of William and Mary, looking at the leaked Roe v. Wade document from the Supreme Court, indicating that there are enough justices willing to overturn that, not the final decision that's expected this summer. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. What is this a decision you'd be happy to see? Are you worried about it? What do you want to see states do if, in fact, this is the final word from the U.S. Supreme Court? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. I want to look at some of the specifics of the laws in states around the country. You've mentioned Texas's. That one, people have pointed out, no exceptions for victims of rape or incest resulting in a pregnancy, some trigger laws in other states as well. It's been pointed out that that's kind of a change in the movement against abortion. Ronald Reagan, who worked against abortion, favored those exceptions. What do you make of that that change?
I do think that this is one of the largest changes from even mid-century. So rape and incest exceptions were first proposed by the American Law Institute in the 1950s and became the model for liberalization of abortion laws across the country. So states like Georgia, states like Colorado accepted these very narrow notions that in cases of rape or incest, fetal abnormality, or the health of women should all be reasons why access to abortion should be legal. The turn against rape and incest really demonstrates that for many states, there's not even the need to pretend that this is a pro-women decision. The notion of the primacy of fetal rights over and above the health and well-being of women and other people who can get pregnant really indicates that this has become such a polarized and extreme issue that there's not room for us to show compassion to anybody who is seeking an abortion.
Are there other laws in states around the country either likely to revert into place or so-called trigger laws that you are keeping a particularly close eye on?
Yeah, I think that right now, Missouri has floated a law that would ban individuals from going outside of the state to have abortions. This is the first time that we haven't seen the invocation of interstate bans that are directed to those who are seeking abortions. That really is an attempt to contravene the idea that if somebody wants to seek an abortion, they should be able to go to a state where it is available. And so that shows an increasingly high level of extremism. There are also several states, as you know, Wisconsin is one of them, where pre-Roe bans on abortion were never taken off the books. And so it will be really at the discretion of state officials of whether or not to enforce those laws. So those will become, I think, increasingly part of how we think about the new landscape of abortion.
Clara McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She's talking to us about what it could be like if Roe v. Wade is officially overturned this summer by the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember a time before Roe v. Wade? Do you have thoughts to share with us? Do you think if Roe is overturned, it'll be the same as back then or different? Do you want Roe v. Wade to be overturned or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Clara McKinney, assistant professor at the College of William and Mary, talking about what things in the U.S. could look like if Roe v. Wade is overturned, as a draft decision leaked to the press has indicated might happen this summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Frank is with us in La Crosse. Frank, hello.
Hi. With all due respect to your guest, in addition to the immediate effects of this ruling, if it goes forward, on women and the misogynistic attitudes that are embodied in it in terms of putting women back in a place where they don't have freedom and don't have power, I think people of all political persuasions need to be alarmed by the reasoning in the brief, which would dramatically or would provide a basis to dramatically reduce individual freedoms and the right to privacy across the political spectrum and across all aspects of the society. It's a much larger issue than just abortion, although abortion, of course, is a critical and important issue. Thank you.
Frank, thanks for the call. Claire, is that a concern you share?
Absolutely. So the leaked decision very clearly lays out that anything that is not explicitly spelled out in the Constitution as a protected liberty has to be rooted in the deep-seated traditions of the United States, which means prior to 1868, there must be a track record that there was an acknowledgement that there was no state authority to regulate these practices. What that means for women, for LGBTQ folks, for racial minorities, all means a huge rollback of liberties. I'll also state that the way that the decision tries to say abortion is the only thing this relies on is to say that the issue of fetal life is one that is morally contentious. But all of the things that we're concerned about now, thinking about the finding unconstitutional anti-sodomy laws, gay marriage, same-sex marriage, thinking about even interracial marriage and contraception, all of these are also issues where we can see moral debate ongoing in the country. And so if the logic is, if it's morally contentious and not rooted in pre-1868 America, then you don't have that liberty, you can see a significant rollback of any recognition of rights for a whole host of minorities.
Frank, thanks for that call. Go to Barbara next in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Barbara?
I have two things to say. I'm a retired nurse anesthetist and nurse. I also have a master's in microbiology. And I hear two arguments from the pro-life people, which I'm pro-life, but I'm also in favor of abortions when necessary, that they don't seem to understand. And one of them is that there is no problem in our society with pronouncing somebody brain dead. And yet they contend that an embryo or a fetus prior to the development of a functioning brain is alive. I don't understand it doesn't make sense. And the other one is this heartbeat bill. Well, at 6 weeks, which is when they're defining it, there is no functional heart. There's a small mass of tissue, but it's not shaped like a heart. It doesn't pump blood. It's not functional. And they talk about, I heard the heartbeat. No, what you heard was a manufactured sound from the sonogram. That is not the heartbeat. The heart is not beating. There are some tissues that are electrically stimulated, but it's like a twitch in your eye. It's not a heartbeat. And I don't think that they understand the difference.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Claire, Barbara getting into an issue of where we consider life to begin and where deadlines are placed on when abortions can happen.
I think that this is a crucial part of the debate that one often kind of looks to as how can we actually settle this in a non-arbitrary way? Unfortunately, I agree with Barbara that any lines that we draw always bring up questions and cases of how do we consider these other ideas, right? Oftentimes we think about how do we think about fertility clinics that store embryos and those fertilized embryos. Why is there not an uproar when those are destroyed when people who had fertility issues decide that they no longer want those embryos? It also brings up the fact that conception itself is not an act, it's a process. Do we say that this happens at fertilization, at implantation? All of these call into question the hard and fast lines that we try to make between life and not life. And honestly, also shows one of the reasons why contraception is in danger on the basis of this ruling if it becomes law.
Thanks, Barbara, for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Clara McKinney from the College of William and Mary, looking at abortion, past and future in the United States, with it looking likely that the Supreme Court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade. Back to your calls now. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hello there. How's it going today? My comment is more of a comment, not really a question. If they successfully rolled this back into banning abortions and stuff, okay, for the conservatives, what is the next step? Are you going to go back and try to get prohibition reinstated? And if you were successful at that, are you going to try to get slavery reinstated in the southern part of the United States? How far are you willing to drag this nation backward in time?
AJ, thanks for the call. Claire, I believe the post-Civil War amendments would pretty specifically prevent the restoration of slavery, but AJ's wondering in what other ways, we talked about this a little earlier, in what other ways could this, in effect, turn back the clock?
Yeah, I think anytime that we see the invocation of states' rights, that often accompanies with the idea of we need to resist the rights and recognition of the full citizenship of people who were previously denied it. So I think in terms of turning back the clock, the most obvious places that you'll see really conservative legislatures go towards is banning same-sex marriage, reintroducing perhaps anti-sodomy laws. But I think that we'll also see contestation over things like IUDs and other forms of birth control that some consider forms of abortifacients, that is, procedures that stop conception from resulting in the development of a fetus. So I think there's a lot of danger here. We've already actually seen the clock turn back on issues like voting rights with Citizens United. We saw the repudiation that the federal government has responsibility for guaranteeing that especially Black Americans, but really any racial minorities ought to be protected in voting. So this is not the first salvo, and it won't be the last in returning us to a time before the full rights and recognition of all people as citizens is taking place.
Thanks for the call. Michael joins us next in Park Falls. Michael, hello.
Hi. My question is along the lines, I guess it's a technical matter. We always hear about exceptions for rape and incest. You know, historically, that was sort of a common exception, but I'm wondering how does that work? Like when who decides that that event has occurred? Is it historically a doctor? Did a court? Because it seems like it's not just.
Michael, that's a good question, Claire. How do those exceptions work on a practical level?
So luckily, since Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, the companion case that we typically don't talk about, rape and incest exceptions haven't really been all that important in how we think about this. I don't know of any cases where the kind of claims of rape or incest have played a role. And unlike the kind of track record of requiring minors to have parental notification or parental consent, there's not really an explicit role for the judiciary to step in order to make these determinations. So what I do think that the question really shows, though, is that when people are asked why they're seeking an abortion, less than 1% ever bring up rape or incest. The vast majority of people who are seeking abortions are doing so for economic reasons, for reasons of their greater kind of fertility life planning. Many of these people, the majority already have children. And so the rape or incest oftentimes is one that plays on our sympathy, but doesn't really guide much in terms of the actual practice of abortion.
Thanks for that call. Claire, in our last minute or so, Democrats in Congress and a couple of Republican senators have said, okay, we need to enshrine the protections of Roe v. Wade in legislation. Some Republicans in the Senate are talking about working on a nationwide ban on abortion if they managed to take control of Congress and eventually the White House. What are you watching for from Congress now?
Honestly, I don't think that there's a lot from Congress that we can hope to see one way or the other. I think that we will continue to see campaigning on these issues, but in terms of having the votes to get over the 60 vote threshold for cloture, you're not going to see much of anything beyond just kind of this activity in raising it to the national level of our consciousness.
And briefly, it's all up to the states then, if in fact Roe v. Wade is overturned?
Yeah, just like the past 40 years, the action will all be on the level of the states.
Claire, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She studies the politics of gender and reproductive health, including abortion. She talked to us today about what could happen if Roe v. Wade is in fact overturned. Again, a Supreme Court leaked draft suggests that it is likely to be overturned this summer. Join great conversations every weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, have some fun. It's a good time to watch for birds here in Wisconsin. Get some advice, and you could share your own sightings out in nature or maybe in your own backyard. Send pictures, too. They love those. Email central or email ideas at WPR.org. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, do you have a second? If so, which second? The old one or the new one? As reported in the New York Times, researchers at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures are getting ready to change the way they define a second. Now, you and I won't notice the difference. Seconds won't get any longer or shorter. So why change it? The goal is to make that unit of time more precise. We humans used to use the sun and other stars and the Earth's rotation to define our units of time. And that works really well in the short run. But for long periods of time, orbits and rotations can slow down just a little bit at a time. And if you're doing serious physics, you need your units of measurement built to last. Right now, the science world uses cesium atoms and their decay to count time, and that's pretty accurate. The goal is to do it even better. Scientists are going to fight it out with a group of elements and optical atomic clocks that'll make things even more precise. That decision will be made over the next couple of years, give or take a second or two. Time news you can use. This is Central Time.